Hi everybody, welcome to the Ontology Summit 2015. Today is the second of our Track C sessions. So today is Thursday the 19th of March, and in Track C we're focusing on decision making in different domains, and as before we will explore several approaches to automated inference in a range of applications, including complex event processing, situation awareness, manufacturing, and so on. We have three great speakers lined up today. We have Marco Rostocher doing a ontological framework for decision support. Then we'll hear from Bill Murdoch on decision making for the IBM Watson question answering utility that I'm sure you've all heard of. And then we'll have Matthew Giannini talking about the role of ontologies in building automation. So if speakers can try and keep to 20 minutes per presentation, I will start to lean on you when we get towards the 5-minute warning, and we'll keep questions till afterwards, but please do all put any questions in the chat as well, so that we've got a nice record of those and of the answers to those. Great. So without further ado then, and as a bit of housekeeping, if people could mute themselves locally, that will just save us a lot of pushing the buttons at this end. We really appreciate that. And just put your hand up when you're ready to speak and unmute yourselves and so on when we come to the question and answering session. So with that, I'd like to introduce Marco Rostocher, who will be speaking on an ontological framework for decision support. So Marco, over to you.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Glad
okay, great. So, hello everybody. I'm Marco Rospocher. I'm a research scientist in the Data Knowledge Management Unit at Fondazione Bruno Kessler, which is a multidisciplinary research institute located in Trento, Italy. And today I will present you a work on adopting an ontological framework in decision support. So now I'm on slide two. Decision support systems are computer-based information systems that supports users in making decisions. So typically, the decision-making process they implement consists in three main phases. Slide three. First, in the problem phase, the users formulates a complete description of the decision problem to be solved by the system. Slide four. In the data phase, according to the problem submitted by the user, the system collects, fuses, and stores all and only the data which are relevant for the problem. And then in the third phase, which is slide five, the conclusion phase, the system processes the data to take a decision on the user problem. Slide six. In the talk, I will present you how myself to adopt our ontology-based knowledge base as the main data structure of a decision support system. In details, the terminological part of this knowledge base formally describes all the details, the content manipulated in the three decision-making phases just described. While each decision support request submitted to the system will be associated to a single connected A box, incrementally instantiated by the decision support system while processing the request in the three phases. As such, at the end of the processing, the A-box associated with the request will contain the problem description, the data processed, and the conclusion produced by the decision support system for that particular request. For this reason, we will also refer to this as a semantic request script. Slide number seven. So before going into the details of our proposal, let me point out what are the advantages it brings. First, it facilitates the integration of the heterogeneous knowledge and data sources. This is especially important now because differently from the past where the decision support system were closed system, in the semantic web area, most of the knowledge and data useful to support a decision are available potentially in a heterogeneous format in the web. And since ontologies are particularly used for data integration, the decision support system task is facilitated by adopting an ontology at the core of its operation. Second, in the semantic services area we are now, a decision support system can be seen as a basically a web service that can be combined with other semantic services to build enhanced integrated systems. So if we are able to represent into a rich semantic track the entire decision process followed by the decision support system in producing conclusion and suggestion, we can also expose it, for example, adopting the linked data principles, enabling the combination of the decision support system with other services available, such as, for example, explanation services that needs the information, not just the input-output, but also all the information used for processing a request to provide explanation for what happened in the decision. And finally, by using the a logical knowledge base, some of the inference step performed by the decision support system can be performed indeed via logical reasoning, as, for example, using a rule reasoner or ontology reasoners. Slide 8, so this is the outline of the talk. I will briefly describe the context of the Pescado European project where the decision support system based on our approach has been implemented. Then I will present the architecture of the knowledge base with all its components. I describe how a semantic request script is incrementally built while processing the request. I'll comment a couple of examples on how semantic request scripts can be exploited. And I conclude basically recalling some information how to properly engineer a decision support knowledge base. So slide number 9, in Pescado, the goal was basically, the goal of the project, which ran from 2010 to 2012, was to develop a multilingual web service platform providing personalized environmental information and decision support. This platform takes advantage of the fact that the web hosts a great range of environmental data sources, which can be websites, web services, open data repositories, that provide, in principle, all the required basic environmental data for taking decisions, weather, information, air quality, pollen. The challenge here is threefold. First, to discover and integrate these environmental data sources, then to process the obtained data in accordance with the decision support request submitted by the user, and finally to communicate the gained information to the in the user preferred mode. We were considering a couple of scenarios during the project. The first one is, for example, of a pollen allergic person which is planning to do some outdoor activities, and he is interested in being notified whether the, for example, the pollen situation in the area might trigger some symptoms or the temperature is too hot for doing some physical exercise. Another situation is, for example, a city administrator that has to be informed whether the current air quality situation in the area she's responsible of require some action to be urgently taken. So in slide 10, I have a couple of pointers to a few videos which basically explains how the system works. I'm now accessing the short one, but there's also a longer version with the voice comment available as well. So I'm about to start in, let's say, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, the video. I just started the video. First, the users formulated the decision support problem. It selects among several type of request type, the one he is interested in this case, he wants to check the air quality in a particular region. So after selecting the request, basically it selects the geographic area to be covered, which she is interested in. So in this case, for example, is an area near Helsinki. Then it selects the time period to be considered in his request, so the time period in which the data had to be retrieved, and then it basically submits the request. In this case, we are considering an administrative user, so it requires a certain type of information. So now in the backend, several services are running. The problem description is instantiated in the ontology. Then the system, according to the problem description, determines which data have to be retrieved. The data are retrieved from website or web services providing this information and are fused in the ontology attached to the problem description. Then the system processes the data and generates user personalized conclusion and data aggregation. And among all the available information, some part of this information is selected and it is translated, is reported in natural language to the user in the language that he is interested in. In the project, we were supporting three languages: English, Finnish, and Swedish. So in the video, you see, for example, that an ozone warning was reported because some exceedance of some air quality limit were exceeded by the data for the selected time period. So now going back to slide number 11 in the presentation. So this show the decision support knowledge base that the idea of the decision support knowledge base that we foresee. So you see that we have a terminological part which contains three components. Slide 12, you see the problem and the data and the conclusion component according to the decision support phase. While in slide 13, you see that each request coming to the system corresponds to an A box, which is instantiated while processing the request. In slide 14, you see that the three components in the terminological part are related by properties, like the S data and S conclusion, which relates a problem with the data relevant for it and the conclusion provided by the decision support system, and the produced conclusion, which relates the data component to the conclusion component. And this is particularly useful for explanation purposes because it represents the fact that a certain conclusion was triggered from a certain data. Slide 15, so the problem component formally describes all the aspects of the decision support system that the user can submit to the system. An example of the model aspect could be the type of request, the profile of the users, the typology, like, for example, whether it's an administrative user or an end user, its age, allergies it might suffer, and also maybe other kind of information, like, for example, the date or other parameter. Note that this component might be used also to constrain the type of problems that can be submitted to the system through the user interface. So slide 16, the Pescado component defined for Pescado consisted in three interrelated parts that you can see in slide 17. So we have a request that describes a taxonomy or request types supported by the system, like those you saw previously in the video. The user component enabled to describe the profile of the user, as mentioned before. The activity defines some type of activity the user might undertake and might affect the type of conclusion and the type of warning that might be generated to the user. Slide 18, so the three subcomponents are actually interrelated by object properties and subclass actions which constrain the possible combination allow, as I was previously mentioning. For instance, you see that in the first one example in the slide, you see that there's a restriction as request user, only administrative user, on the class checker quality limits, which basically states that type of request can be submitted only by administrative users. And we were using this information in the Pescado user interface by reading basically this information and constraining the choices in the user interface that the user had to formulate the request. We have also additional parameter in defining this component, like the time, the period of the request, and the location considered. Slide 19 is the data component. So the purpose of a data component in our decision support knowledge base is to describe the data accessed and manipulated by the decision support system and all the aspects of the data that might affect the conclusion taken. You can see this somehow as the domain ontology of the decision support system, in a sense that different from the other two components the problem and the conclusion component, this is less application oriented than the previous two. So potentially an ontology that can be used as data component might be already available in the web. And I want to remark the fact that by adopting an ontological representation of the data processed by the decision support system, we favor the integration of structured data already available coming from heterogeneous sources like website or linked open data nodes. Slide 20, the data component for Pescado was clearly focused on environmental data, so information like meteorological data, pollen, air quality. There was several details that was possible to model, like whether data was a forecast or an historical data. We also encoded the mapping between qualitative and quantitative values, and also the data sources, which basically represents from where the information was collected, whether a measurement station, a website, or a web service. The adoption basically of this ontological representation here facilitated the extraction of data from different sources. For example, in Pescado, we were extracting content from text in the web pages, or even from by processing basically images. You can skip slide 21 and 22 and go directly to 23. Finally, so we have the conclusion component in our T-box part. So this component describes the type of conclusion that the decision support system can produce. For example, like warnings, suggestions, instructions, but also data aggregation or the results of some data analysis. You can think that you can attach a weight to this information produced, which might represent the confidence or the relevance for the user of this particular information produced. And I want to remark the fact that there is the possibility to track the information from where a conclusion was generated from which data, using the produced conclusion property. Slide 24, the Pescado conclusion component described things like exceedance of air pollutant limit values, warning and recommendation triggered by environmental condition. For example, in slide 25 on the left, you see the type of conclusions, like, for example, warnings related to some particular pollutant. While on slide 26, you see one example of a particular warning type that it would possible, if detected, it was possible to report, like in this case, the exceedance of some limit related to NO2. A warning basically is instantiated in the knowledge base, in the A box for the current request as a new individual attached to this type and potentially a weight value telling how much that information was relevant for the problem and according to the data processed. So a decimal value between 0 and 1. A slide 27, the final component is the A box of each request. So associated this A box is associated to each request while processing the request. So it's basically a set of individuals and assertion of them instantiated according to the three components in the T-box part of the ontology. As you can see here, for example, we have some assertion about the problem. These it's a problem for an allergic person that wants to do some physical outdoor activity. Then in slide 28, you see the data assertion that were retrieved by the system from a website or other repositories. In slide 29, I remark the fact that the problem, the data get attached to the current problem with some assertion. In slide 30, you see some example of conclusions generated, instantiated in the A box according to the type of conclusion available and supported by the system. In slide 31, you can see that there were several assertions stating that that conclusion is relative to that problem and that some particular data triggered that particular conclusion. So slide 32, this A box, this semantic request script, is built coherently with the main phases of the decision-making process, and it's incrementally built in the three phases, so the creation of the problem, the data, and the conclusion. In each of these phases, the fact that we used an ontology as the main data structure of the system allowed us to exploit some logical reasoning to perform some of the tasks of the decision support. In the first phase, the instantiation of the problem, for example, a consistency check of the input instance with the schema defined by the T-box can be performed via reasoning, using potentially some closed world reasoning, to verify that the user request is compliant with the problem supported by the decision support system. And this is particularly useful if you think that the system can be used maybe in some situation as a web service, so you get the request and you can check if you can actually satisfy the request coming from outside. In the second phase, the instantiation of the data, the decision support system determines which data are relevant for the user decision supported request submitted. And for this purpose, different strategies and techniques can be exploited. In Pescado, for example, we encoded using some restriction, some mappings between the three parts of the problem component, so the user, activity, and request component, and the type of environmental data formalized in the data component to represent that a certain environmental data are relevant for some problematics. So in the example, for example, in the slide, you see that we have this restriction, which is attached to user search pollen, which basically states that data about rain has to be retrieved for requests submitted by this type of user, and this it was possible to determine simply using a VR reasoner and checking the new instances attached to the individual representing the actual user in the problem request. In the third phase, we were instantiating the conclusions, and here again, different strategy can be applied. In Pescado, for instance, we implemented a module responsible for computing conclusion, which combines complementary techniques like VR reasoning and rule-based reasoning. In particular, we had a two-layers infrastructure. In the first layer exploit the Hermit RO reasoner for performing the DR reasoning computation, and the second layer stacked on top of the previous one was implemented as a Jena RET rule engine and was performing rule-based reasonings like, for example, exactly implementing firing basically rules. Slide 33. At the end of the decision support computation, the A-box, as mentioned, the A-box associated to a decision support request contains a semantic snapshot of all the information processed and produced by the decision support system for the given request. So it has a complete description of the user request, the data relevant for the request and that were used to perform the computation, and the conclusion and the inferred content produced by the system, together with the explanation on what triggered those conclusions. All this information can be actually used to generate automatically text summarizing and explaining in natural language the most relevant information reported in the user. This automatic generated text might be particularly useful, for example, for laymen, people not very familiar with technical information, or it may even be spread across to communication channel by media corporation. This is what I shown you in the short video about the Pescado system at the end of the video. In Pescado, actually, we adopted an approach for multilingual personalized information generation from a dynamically instantiated ontology, and it was composed of two models. The first one, the text planning module, enriched the semantic request script with information on the content to be selected and the way the text should be organized, and then this enriched ontology is actually the input for the linguistic generation module, which produces the text in the language supported by the system. Slide 34, so you see in the example of a text automatically generated from the ontology, part of this text is pre-canned like the ozone warning text, but the other information on the top part was actually automatically generated from the instantiated ontology. Slide 35. So this semantic request script produced by the system can also be archived, for example, in some Triple Store, that is incrementally fed with all the requests produced by the system. And you can use this information for several purposes. Just to mention one of them, you can compute some analysis on the request performed, and you can decide to fine-tune the processing performed by your system according to the traces of all the previous requests processed by the system. Slide 36, just some final comment on how to engineer a decision support knowledge base. So besides performing the classic check on the formal consistency of the ontology of the ontology and the decision in the knowledge base and checking the correct instantiation while using the ontology with the system under implementation, there are some further activity to be performed to check, for example, that the problem defined in the ontology cover all the ones supported, plan to be supported by the system, that all the type of data can be characterized in the data component, and that all the type of conclusion and explanation to be generated by the system are actually formalized in the conclusion component. And for doing this, for example, in Pescado, for the problem part, we had a use case specification document, and we check that all type of problem defined there were covered by our problem component. While for the data and the conclusion part, we run an evaluation with some expert, and we provide them some closed questionnaire reporting the type of information, for example, the type of data and the type of conclusion generated by the system using the ontology. And the result show that despite some minor adjustment, the T-box part of the knowledge base was adequate with respect to the considered aspects. Slide 37, which is basically the conclusion. So in this paper, in this presentation, I presented a proposal to adopt an ontology-based knowledge base as the main data structure of the decision support system. In our approach, each decision support request submitted to the system corresponds to a semantic request script in the knowledge base, which describes in a structured way the request itself, the data relevant for the request, and the conclusion, suggestion, and decision generated by the system by processing the data. We presented the possible advantages offered by the proposal, and I show you how we actually applied it in the concrete context of the Pescado Europrium project. In particular, I show that this semantic representation enabled to integrate heterogeneous sources of data available in the web, for example, coming from website or web service, to track and expose in a structured form to additional service all the content processed and produced by the decision support system for each request, and to exploit logical reasoning for several of the inference steps in the decision support decision-making process. Slide 38, this just summarizes some of the reference of the work here presented. The first one is basically the description of the paper describing the approach in general. The second one is a paper which describes in particular the T-box of the knowledge base developed for Pescado, ontology which is also available on the OntoHub repository under the FOIS ontology competition. The third paper reports more in general the use of the ontology in Pescado. And the final one, for those of you interested in the Pescado decision support system in general, its architecture, you can look at the fourth paper. You can access all of them in preprint form from my webpage. So basically, that's it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Marco. That was excellent. Thanks. And I see there's a number of questions. Will you be around at the end of the call to be able to answer those?
Unfortunately, I have to leave in half an hour, but I will try to collect all this information. So I don't know if you want to that we can try to answer now, or I can collect all the questions and then try to reply later on or tomorrow in the chat.
Sorry.
Okay, so in that case, I think, Marco, if you could answer some of the questions in the chat before you go, just a quick one.
Yes,
line up.
Yes, sure.
That would be fantastic. You see there's about four or five questions people put there, and then I'm sure we'll have more discussion on that later. So,
yes.
Thank you very much.
So I see, shall I go through the chat, or do you...
Just go to the chat and type in answers, so you'll see that you've got questions from, for example, Todd Schneider, Amanda Bysdom, Bob in Teagarden, and so on. If you could just answer those in text before you go, just to
pick
up. Yes, I'm
text?
Yes, please.
Okay, so I type them in text.
Yeah, please. Thank you.
Okay.
Fantastic. So then it's time for Dr. William Murdoch of the IBM Watson Research Center, who will be talking to us about decision making in the IBM Watson question answering. So, Bill, over to you.
Hi. So you said that there, or someone said there's, that the original PDF slides are up on the wiki too somewhere.
Yes, they are. Yes. So from the session page, there's a link to the PDF already, and I believe by now there'll also be a link to PowerPoint if people prefer that. So if you could call out the. No, I see it's still just, oh yes, now it's been replaced by a link to PowerPoint.
It's been replaced. Okay, cool. So I'll load that up on my terminal. I think it's better if people have access, have the ability to do so, to follow along on the PDF, I mean, sorry, on the PPATX, because that's going to have the animations. It'll be a little bit easier to see things. It's not going to make a big difference. If you're following along on the PDF, you should be able to follow along just fine, too.
Lovely. You can call out the slide numbers as you go. I see they're not numbered as such, but the slider on the side will tell you what the number is. So that would be great. Thanks.
Yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, for that purpose, I think I'll probably need to go to work from the PDF myself because there is no slider on the in PowerPoint Viewer. So I'm going to work from the PDF. If people can follow along with either, but I won't be able to tell people when to click through the animations. Anyway, this is how it is. So I'm Bill Murdoch. I'm going to be talking about decision making in IBM Watson. Slide two provides a brief introduction to IBM Watson. It's an automated question answering system. It was originally designed to compete on a television game show, Jeopardy, which is a very popular American television game show. It competed against two grand champions. The match appeared on TV in February of 2011, and Watson won the match, outscoring both opponents combined. Since 2011, we've been working on a wide variety of applications of this technology, such as medicine and customer service. Slide three, I have an overview and an outline of the talk. The first section of the talk is going to be talking about deciding on what answers we want to show users. That's really the main decision-making task within IBM Watson, within question answering more generally, is deciding what are the answers. IBM Watson generates many candidate answers, and for each answer, we have to decide how confident are we that that answer is right. So other decision-making tasks in IBM Watson include deciding whether to answer based either on some combination of how confident are we that the answer is right, and based also on the cost benefit of right answers and wrong answers. So I'll say a little bit about that. And I'll say a little bit about deciding how many answers to provide, how many answers to show the user, and also deciding on whether to hedge, whether to indicate that you're not really sure what the answer is before actually providing an answer. So the slide four is showing the Jeopardy Watson system, the general architecture of Jeopardy Watson. This is one of the animated slides, so you'll have to sort of step through the little dialogue things one at a time if you're using the PPTX version. The Jeopardy Watson system starts with a question. Runs some textual analysis of the question to analyze the question and the topic of the question. It's going to use some combination of statistical and rule-based natural language processing. There's a hypothesis generation step that generates candidate answers. There's a hypothesis and evidence scoring step that scores the candidate answers. It's going to add more features It's going to retrieve additional evidence and use that evidence to add more features. So the point is, at the end of all of those steps, you have a bunch of instances, which are answers, and you have features on them, numerical values on them, which a statistical machine learning component on the far right can use to rank and score the answers. So there's a set of statistical models. Each answer to each question is going to be an instance. There'll be some sort of score assigned to it. The answers with the high scores are the high-ranked answers. The highest one is the top answer, the one you actually want to respond to in a Jeopardy context, respond to in a Jeopardy context. And there'll be a confidence score associated with it, so we'll have some sense of whether we want to respond to it, and I'll say more about those later on. So this architecture shows the Jeopardy Watson. I'm going to talk about a couple more recent incarnations of Watson as well in the next couple of slides. On slide five, I'm talking about Watson Paths, which is an application designed originally for medical diagnosis, but more generally for the kinds of tasks where you're dealing with complex scenarios that you can split into many assertions and then analyze each assertion separately and see how they combine to lead you to an answer. So inside of Watson Paths is essentially the same question answering system. Some of the details are a little different. You might have different answer scoring components and different deep evidence scoring components and things like that. But the outline is basically the same outline we saw on the previous slide. It's basically the same machine learning at the end of the pipeline that comes up with a ranked list of answers and their confidence scores. The big difference is sort of outside of that, the thing that's invoking this many times. In the upper left, you see that there's a scenario that's an input. The scenario is broken down into a set of assertions. Each assertion motivates some sort of question, and this is done through an ontology. In the medical application, we have a medical ontology that knows about entities, and it knows about relationships among entities. So if in your scenario there's a patient that has a symptom, you might have an assertion that patient has symptom, and that might motivate a question like, what causes that symptom, or what medicines will treat that symptom? So each assertion leads to questions, which can then lead to new assertions. Through this, you'll build a big graph of assertions, relationships among those assertions, degrees of confidences of those relationships. And the expectation is that across the various assertions, you'll get evidence flowing towards a conclusion. And more evidence flowing towards better conclusions and less evidence flowing towards worse conclusions. Now, because this is a language-based question answering system, no one step in this is guaranteed to be accurate, but they all have some reasonably high level of accuracy. And the expectation is that even if you can't be assured that any one edge in this big graph of assertions is correct, the fact that there's confidence scores on them and the fact that you have a lot of redundancy, a lot of different edges that hopefully in net all point to the right answer means that some of the impreciseness of each individual link can be washed away in the sort of mass of belief flowing among the different links. So you wouldn't want to think this as a logical network where one wrong assertion breaks the whole thing because you can conclude false and then you can conclude anything from false. This is much more like a belief network where you're never really sure of anything, but rather you're letting confidence scores flow among them. I guess for the main point from here is that this is sort of the same fundamental technology used to decide on an answer, but the difference is that an answer in this context is just a step along the way, and it's not a final conclusion that gets reported to the user. So that's the Watson Path system. So moving on to slide number six here, I have a similar chart for the Watson Engagement Advisor. Now, Engagement Advisor is handling individual input questions from a user, and so in that sense, it's more like Jeopardy. But unlike Jeopardy, it has multiple alternative pipelines that all separately generate answers and score answers. Those multiple alternative pipelines, however, then are all fed into essentially the same statistical machine learning component that you saw in the Jeopardy, Watson, and the Watson Paths application. There's one thing that knows how to take in question-answer pairs with features on them, and then at training time, learn models that will tell you whether those answers are right or wrong with some confidence. And then at apply time, when you're actually running the system, it will use those models. It will take actual answers generated by the system. It will assign confidence scores to them, and then ultimately generate some final answer in confidence or some set of answers in confidence at the end. So this final merging and ranking, final confidence merging and ranking component in the lower right of slide six, which appeared in the lower right of also of slide four and five, is in some sense the component that's responsible for deciding on what answer to use. And so I'm going to drill down a little bit more into this box and what it means and how it works in this presentation. And slide seven provides sort of an overview of what final confidence merging and ranking is about. It starts with some combination of either answers in isolation, which has feature values, or answers embedded in evidence with feature values. So I'll show an example in a moment. The final confidence merging and ranking has a big complex configuration file, which has configuration information for each individual feature, such as what to do when it's missing. Typically, if feature F is missing, then we'll set F equal to 0, and we'll set a new feature called F dash missing to 1. So that way, the learner can learn what to impute as a missing feature based on whatever makes the model most effective at classifying, just distinguishing right answers from wrong answers. But that's configurable for each feature. There's a feature called standardization that I'll talk about on the next slide. For each feature, we configure how to merge across instances. For example, some features you really want to take the if you have multiple instances that are equivalent, you want to take the maximum. Other ones you want to take the minimum because typically that's because the minimum is better for that feature. The feature is trying to say something where small values are indicative of the answer being right. And so if you have two different pieces of evidence, one that doesn't support it much and one that supports it strongly, you want to take the one that supports it strongly and treat that as evidence in favor of it. And usually for many features that's done by max, but for some features it's done by min. Others you want to combine evidence across instances. You might want to do a sum or a decaying sum where you get full credit for the first one and this partial credit for the second one, et cetera. So all that's configured within the final confidence merging and ranking. The final confidence merging and ranking will combine equivalent answers and merge feature values according to however those features were configured. Let's say here's my example. Let's say we have four candidate answers. The first candidate answer has label frog. It's an answer in isolation, so it's not assigned to any particular piece of evidence. And it has feature F1 equal to 3, F2 equal to 4, F3 equal to 1. So some analysis was done and some feature values were assigned to this candidate of frog. The second candidate is called order Anura, which is the scientific name for the frog order. And it also has some feature value assigned to it. Because these are equivalent, we'd like the merging and ranking to say they're equivalent and treat those as one answer and combine the feature values for those two different surface forms of this one underlying answer. And then in addition, in this example, there's two answer frog appears in two different pieces of text. There's one that says frogs like ponds. There's another that says I saw a frog in a pond. So typically the kinds of features that you get on an answer in context are different from the kind of features you get from an answer in isolation because we have different kinds of components that score evidence in context and that score evidence out of context. So you'll have some additional features there. And then the final merger and ranker, its job is to first collapse all those instances into one instance with one label and one feature vector, one set of values for each of those features that are known in the system. And then once you have it down to the level of here's the label, here's an instance with a label, here's a bunch of feature values, the answer key says whether it's right or wrong, then at training time, you can record these features in class label and train a model that gives high scores to the right answers and low scores to the wrong answers. And then at runtime, you apply that model to the same feature vector to compute a confidence score and determine how likely it appears to be that this particular answer that you're analyzing is a correct answer. So slide 8 is one of my more complicated animated slides, so it'll look a little bit different for people on the PDF file versus the PPT file. Sorry about that. Anyway, I'm going to try and walk through it quickly. This slide is describing a process called standardization. In the upper row of this slide, you can see an example where I have two features, F1 and F2, and I have green dots indicating right answers and red dots indicating wrong answers. And these features, F1 and F2, collectively, they're very good features in the sense that the green dots are consistently higher than the red dots. So for question 1, question 2, question 3, the green dots are consistently and reliably higher than the red dots. If you trust F1 and F2, those features will tell you which answers are right and which answers are wrong. So the problem comes if you then take all three of those questions and you take those dots for those questions and you overlay them on top of each other, as you see down in the lower left. In this case, you're looking at cross questions. It's much harder to use these features to separate the right answers from the wrong answers. Some of the green dots in the middle are not as good as some of the red dots for some of the other questions in terms of F1 and F2, and there isn't really a way to draw a line through this graph in the lower left that separates the reds from the greens. The features are not as effective for separating purposes. So the point of standardization is to correct for the fact that different questions have different sort of different baselines, different distributions for these features, where a feature might be very useful within a question, but have different meanings across questions. And so you're trying to correct for that. And so basically what standardization does is it subtracts the mean for that question and divides by the standard deviation for that question. And the animation in the lower middle that chart on this slide shows how the standardization works. The subtracting the mean pulls all the points to the middle of the graph, and then dividing by the standard deviation will either spread them out or squeeze them in. And so the across questions, the extent to which they're spread out or squeezed in becomes consistent. And once you do that, then features like this that are sort of reliable within question but behave differently across questions, that characteristic gets standardized out. The ones that are among the lowest for these feature values across questions get roughly the same values at the sort of the low end of the standardized, and the ones that are the highest get roughly the same values on the high end, and so you get a feature which sort of behaves consistently across questions, and you can use that feature more effectively to classify, and it's much easier to separate the space of wrong answers and right answers, as you see in the combined standardized graph in the lower right of this diagram. So the main point here is that the standardization lets you make use of what you know about how the feature behaves within a single question and how it behaves across questions to correct for the fact that some features are not as that are more reliable within a question than across questions. So these questions are important groupings that get lost if you're training the thing by just simply taking each individual question answer pair as an instance at training time and ignoring the fact that they're part of a larger set of instances for a single question. So that's the purpose of standardization. It's I think one of the more important techniques we have in final confidence merging and ranking to make effective use of the raw features that we get from analyzing questions and answers and how they relate to each other and how they relate to evidence.
5 minutes.
Sure. I have a bunch of stuff in here about the phases and routes of learning on slide 9 and 10. Let's skip over that since we're running a little low on time. Let's skip down to slide 12. The Jeopardy-Watson system and the other configurations described so far rank answers one at a time using logistic regression. The learning is based on one instance at a time. Now, in theory, it should be possible for a system to do a better job ranking answers by looking at them as a group, not looking at them one at a time. Now, this basic idea of a learning a ranking over sets of answers as opposed to just learning competences on individual answers is well studied in the field, and it's very successful in other applications. We tried some technologies that are well established for doing that in Jeopardy-Watson and found that it was generally not more effective than the multi-phase logistic regression that that I described earlier, or that was covered in some of the earlier slides. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is that we're not really scoring them one at a time in isolation. The standardization and the multiple phases are actually reasonably effective ways to let the multiple answers to a particular question influence each other. And so you get some of the benefits of learning to rank in this one at a time answer classification framework simply by doing things like standardization and having phases. So that's one reason why it's hard for learning to rank to beat what we're doing with logistic, because what we're doing has some of the characteristics of learning to rank. Another reason is that we design the features and we test them using logistic regression, because that's what we have in there now. And then we discard the features that are not effective. We don't bother continuing to develop them and improve them. As a result, we wind up with a pool of features that are well-suited to logistic regression because we picked the ones that we were effective in logistic, and we continue to refine them based on what makes them more effective in logistic. And so we have a feature set that is really well-tuned to the learning algorithm we are using, because that's how we've evaluated these features in the past. With all that said, however, the field of learning to rank has continued to progress. It really does have a fundamental advantage on learning to rank, which is what we're trying to do here. So I would stay tuned to this. I think we're starting to see some preliminary results in some applications that are promising. I don't have anything to report at this time, but I think learning to rank is going to be an important part of the future of IBM Watson and how it ranks and scores answers. So that's what I wanted to say about choosing answers to questions. Another really important decision for a question answering system to make is deciding whether to answer. Skipping down to slide 14, in Jeopardy, if you answer wrong, you lose money. It's very important to not answer when you don't know the answer. And this was a big part of what motivated us to pursue Jeopardy. We wanted to explore systems that know what they don't know, because we feel that's an important problem for business applications. Now, there's lots of Jeopardy in data. Jeopardy has lots of data that lets us optimize win rates based on outcomes, because there's a huge number of games that have been played, and there's a lot of information on the web about what was done in each game. And the Jeopardy Watson 1.0 system had extensive game-playing capabilities for key Jeopardy decisions, like what category to select, how much to wager, and particularly whether to try and answer a question. So the core Watson question answering capability is responsible for selecting an answer like we saw in the earlier slides and deciding how likely the answer is to be correct. But the Watson Jeopardy game playing application then decides whether to answer using that confidence that it got from the core question answering system and using the game state. For example, if Watson is far, far behind in a score, it might take bigger risks to try and catch up. If it's got a huge lead, it may not be wanting to take a risk, even if it is reasonably confident, because it feels it can just coast to victory without having to take risks. It's a relatively complex decision as to whether to answer or not, particularly late in the game when you have a lot of information about how a particular outcome will affect your likelihood of winning. So similarly, in business applications, the core Watson question answering is still responsible for this basic task of ranking answers and assigning confidence scores. And then individual applications have their own logic for what to do with this ranking and confidence scores. For example, applications with very casual users may want to avoid wasting the user's time with answers that have a low probability of correctness, that might be right, but have a pretty high chance of being wrong. In contrast, if you have an application that has highly motivated users, particularly ones that are good at assessing answers themselves and can sift through the bad answers to find the good ones, then you may want to be a lot more aggressive and show answers even when you have relatively low confidence, because you know that the users might be able to use it because there's some chance that it's right. So those decisions are tied a lot to what it is you're trying to accomplish with answering the question, and I'll get more into that later. So slide 15 has a statistical process model of what happens when humans try to answer questions, how often they get things right and wrong, and what are the consequences. And in particular, if you're wrong, there's a decent chance one of your opponents will go after you and then try and answer the question. And so the consequences are not just that you got it wrong, but also that your opponent gets a chance to answer and get it right. If you don't try and answer, then there's even more chance that one of your opponents will try and get in and try and get it right. And so you have to balance out not just how much is it going to help you or hurt you from answering, but also how much is it going to help or hurt your opponents. So I put this slide in here mainly to motivate slide 16, which is, could we do something similar in business applications? So if you have a situation where a customer asks a question about a product, Watson can try to answer, or Watson can admit that it doesn't know the answer. Now, if you try and answer and you get it right, maybe you increase your chances of buying the product, your customer buying the product. But if you try and answer and get it wrong, maybe you hurt your chances, and maybe you're better off admitting that you didn't know, letting the customer re-ask the question or find the answer another way. But typically, you don't have these statistics. You don't know what are the percents of each of these things. As I mentioned, the core Watson is really just giving you answers and confidence, and the application has to make this decision. I think generally they don't do something like this graph you see here. Generally, they just have a confidence threshold, and they base it on some sort of subjective judgment of what's good enough for user experience. They have to be at least this accurate, or else the users don't even want to see your answer. We just don't have the data to do this sort of deep statistical analysis. I think that will change in the future as we get more deployed applications that gather more data, that have more logging information. I think we'll do a better job at this decision, but we're not there yet. So are we out of time at this point?
Yeah. Can you wrap it up, please?
Sure. So there's a couple other decisions that need to be made in the system. You can see some of the slides about that. It's not just whether to answer, but how many answers to show. Do you want to waste time, your user's time, with more answers than they want in the hopes that at least one of them will be good? The slide has some references at the end, and I think that's about all I wanted to cover.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll take questions after the next presentation, but if people do have questions, start typing them into the thing as well. So next we have Matthew Giannini from Sky Foundry, who will be talking about the role of ontologies in building automation. So Matthew, over to you.
All right, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. And if everybody else could mute themselves locally, that would be lovely. Thank you.
Well, great. First, I'd like to thank the Ontology Summit for inviting me to speak today at Sky Foundry and to introduce people to Project Haystack, an important project in the building automation market. I've been asked today to talk about the role that ontologies play in the building automation market. I'd like to give you a little background about what we mean when we say building automation, what the ontological landscape historically looks like and looks like today, and where we are trying to take it with the Project Haystack initiative. Then I'll spend a little time diving more into the technical details of how Project Haystack is implemented, how we model and consume data using Project Haystack. And finally, time permitting, I'll provide a brief overview, an example of how we actually use Project Haystack in the real world to enable tools in the areas of building analytics, reporting, and visualization. Slide two. So what is a building? This is not really a trick question. It can be anything as small as a residential home. Historically, that has not been a good area for building automation to get into because it's been so expensive, but more and more these days we're seeing IoT kind of devices getting into the home, so it's relevant now. It could be fast food restaurants, department stores, and then more interesting use cases are collections of buildings, things like business parks, college campuses, or even entire cities. The scope really expands in what we're able to control these days. Next slide, slide three. What's in a building? So this is the kind of things we want to automate or control. It could be heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems, a lot of HVAC. There are metering systems inside most buildings to measure energy usage, gas usage, water consumption, lighting systems from parking lots to the actual lighting within the building itself. There are security systems with video cameras and badge readers, door access, things of that nature. Traditionally, these first four are what we typically have been wanting to monitor and control when we talk about building automation. But over time, more and more devices are adding network connectivity of some sort, and really the kind of devices that are in a building comes to be viewed more as a collection of things that I have access to via any protocol, really. So this is the IoT, IP-connected things. Slide four. So here we have the general landscape as it stands today in building automation. Modern building automation systems, EAS, we sometimes say, make data collection relatively easy to accomplish. And the kind of data that we're able to collect is environmental conditions, energy usage, equipment operation, and really there's tons of things you can do. So then we have access, next slide, slide five. We have access to data, all kinds of glorious data. All these systems, they use data. You would be maybe shocked, maybe not, to know how many sensors and controls and how much data you can actually pull out of many of these systems. So data is key these days. Data is business opportunity. It's a way to make money. Hopefully using it for purposes of good, not for evil, like Mr. Burns would. But if it's so readily available, we can create all kinds of cool applications to add business value to this data, right? I have access to energy meter data, so I can do cost and billing analysis for my building, right? I have access to all the fan temperature sensors, set points for all the air handling units in my building, so I can easily find problems in the operation of my equipment, right? And I manage 10 business parks in different regions of the country, so I can take these applications and easily deploy them from one business park to another, right? Slide six. Oh, wrong. There is a problem. The data as it stands today is pretty hard to utilize, and there's a number of reasons for this. The data is in different formats. People are using inconsistent naming conventions when deploying these systems. The data is low level. Oftentimes, sensor data is stacked into bytes, and it's not very easy to consume without software that specifically knows the protocol. We have lack of limited data descriptors, and it's just unorganized. You have all this data, and you don't really know what to do with it. In other words, the data lacks information to describe the meaning of the data. It lacks semantics or metadata. This makes the data difficult to utilize across different applications. EAS software and hardware systems historically have been concerned with programming and control of equipment they oversee and manage. It has been a neglected or secondary concern to also take into account the semantic meaning of this data outside the context of just system control. Another problem is that it's expensive to map this data into other software systems. The translation process is essentially, mapping is essentially a translation problem, and it's very expensive to do. Especially if, like, even within the same building, you'll see that across different floors or even across different campuses or whatever, people have installed the same systems in different ways, so you can't just go from one building to another and have your application working. We're on slide seven. So if only the data that these systems are giving us had context, that would tell us where it fits in the overall system and building. If only we had a common vocabulary when talking about the points or data within these systems. This is an example, like very common, you would go into a system or building and the discharge air temperature for one AHU might be called DA underscore temp. But some other system integrator might go in and call the exact same points on a different AHU, AHU one underscore temp underscore DA. So this is problematic. If only we had a common model for describing these things. For example, suppose I'm measuring the kilowatt hours consumed by a building. I want to be able to go to a McDonald's or a Las Vegas casino, and if the site meter and sub meters are all modeled the same way and carry the same semantic data with them. Doesn't matter who installed the system or how big or how small the job is. Slide 8. Well, Project KSEC is the answer, the solution for these problems. Project KSEC has a vision. We believe that a standardized methodology for describing data will make it easier and more cost-effective to analyze, visualize, and drive value from all this operational data. So at this point, I just want to provide a high-level overview of Project KSEC and how this vision is realized, and then I'll drop down and go into some more of the technical details. Slide 9. So what is KSEC? KSEC is semantics through tagging. Over the course of the presentation, by the way, you'll probably hear me say AHU a lot, but that's just the air handling unit. Try not to use too many acronyms from building automation. So let's go back to our example of the DA underscore temp, discharge air temperature. That's just a name, but in HASEC, we can associate tags with that point. For example, we'll still give the point a name, AHU1 sat, sensor air temperature, and the name by itself is not really sufficient to solve the problem of data modeling. There's just too much information to be contained in a name, especially when you want to start viewing your system in terms of sites, buildings, floors, campuses, things of that nature. So then we add some descriptive tags to this point. This is a sensor. It's discharge, air, temperature. It's measured in degrees Fahrenheit. And in addition to the descriptive tags, it has associations with other entities or points. And we do that via reference tags. So it has a pointer to the AHU this point is for, an AHU1. So this simple example shows that with just a few standard tags, we've already begun to bring order to the chaos that is all the information coming out of these building equipment. Slide 10. What else is KSEC? KSEC is a set of standard equipment models developed by consensus of the community. It's an ongoing effort by Birds of the Feather to develop tagging models for equipment systems based on the HASEC tagging methodology. So really, the important point here is that it's an open source initiative that's licensed under the Academic Free License. We take the main experts who are really interested in this and have a lot of knowledge, and they contribute their knowledge and understanding to help construct these models. Slide 11. HASEC is also a highly efficient REST API that makes it easy to exchange data among applications that understand HASEC. So it's more than just being able to describe something, you can actually use it among systems. We provide an open source Java reference implementation of the REST API that you can use in your applications. And it's a collection of community tools. Project KSEC is really about getting the building automation community involved and working together to build this consensus. So for example, if you're familiar with Niagara Systems, it's a very popular building automation system in the space. We have an NHASEC module that can be used to make HASEC or to make Niagara systems look like they're speaking HASEC. It's really useful. Other people have contributed tools that help streamline the tagging in their systems. Next slide, slide 12. So how does HASEC solve the problem? Using HASEC, applications receive data that includes the metadata essential to describing the meaning of the data. We don't just get the value of a sensor. We know what kind of sensor it is, where it is located, its unit, what equipment it's a part of, what schedule it's on, et cetera. This enables automatic interpretation of the data by software applications, which in turn dramatically reduces the engineering effort, and that means lower costs. And in addition to that, we have a machine-readable format that software applications can use to communicate with one another, and we have a people-readable format so that we can read those others as well. So what does HASEC give us? Slide 13, semantic data, glorious semantic data. Data plus semantics equals actionable data that we can use for any number of applications we can imagine. Slide 14. At this point, I'm just going to go in a little bit more and put some flesh on the bones of what we've been talking about. In an effort to honor the time limit, I'll skip probably through a few of these slides because a lot of the details are on the Project KSEC website, but I do want to talk about how we actually model things in Project KSEC. to slide 15. Let's go into the data modeling. What's the domain? Well, we kind of hit on this earlier. A domain is a set of things you actually want to model. So in building automation, you want to model buildings, equipment systems, points that include sensors, actuators, commands, set points, anything basically that's going to fit to the internet. Slide 16. Meta model. A meta model defines how we describe our model. If you want to model our domain, which is buildings, equipment, and points, et cetera, using a relational database, we would do it in terms of schema, of tables, and columns. If we're modeling something in Java, we use classes, interfaces, and, member variables. If you're using OBIX, which is the Open Building Information Exchange, popular within building automation systems, we would use OBIX contracts or prototype comparison. Slide 17. What effect has the meta model to you? And I just want to go over some of the core concepts and terms. So we say entities model a physical or logical object, such as a HU or an electric meter or a site. Tags define a fact or attribute about an entity as a name value pair. So an entity is just a set or collection of name value pairs, the tags. Tags are simple and dynamic. They have structure. They provide flexibility needed to establish self-describing models of diverse systems and equipment. Tags allow systems to be interpreted by external applications using a standard defined methodology and vocabulary. Tag names are standardized, so Project KSAC defines some common set of tags for describing things such as AHUs and electric meters and things like that, chillers. But you can also create vendor-specific tags or whatever you need for your individual projects. And there's a special tag called ID, which is essentially the primary key or unique identifier for an entity within the Haystack system. Slide 18. What kind of values can be stored in Haystack tags? You support the typical data values you might suspect. I just want to draw your attention to a few of these. For numbers, we support integers and doubles with an optional unit. So within building automation system, there's rarely just a number hanging around without any unit meaning. So we build a unit directly into the concept of a number, such as 72.4 degrees Fahrenheit or 6,750 feet squared for maybe the area square footage of a building. We support ISO 8601 dates and times and also date times. With the addition with the date time, this is kind of important of the time zone and name. This is really important for pulling historical data out of these systems and making sure that we're correlating it correctly across time zones. We have marker tags, which just indicate an is-a or type of relationship. We have refs to other entities, and coordinates, and binary mime types. Slide 19. So here's like a concrete example of a point entity, kind of going back to our discharge air temperature again. Here we have a few tags that describe this entity. You have its ID, which is its unique identifier reference. It has a display name, and then a few marker tags, discharge air temperature sensor as a point. It has a reference to its site. It has a reference to its equipment that it's a part of. We know what kind it is. It's a number measured in degrees Fahrenheit. And the time zone it's in is in New York. So this is a concrete example of modeling a point entity in a stack. Slide 20. So there are some minimum requirements for modeling facilities-oriented applications and BAS systems. Site equipment point entities define the modeling standard for buildings and energy and facility management. And that's what this diagram illustrates. It illustrates those entities and the relationships to one another. And this is core to the modeling. So a site is an individual facility that is intended to be treated as a single entity. You notice that the site entity has a site marker tag. And we highly recommend associating internet available weather stations with a site. This is really important for correlating equipment operation versus weather versus how, like, for example, the set point is or for your air handling units and your HVAC systems. We have equipment entities. Equipment represents assemblies of mechanical or electrical devices. Equipment tags include standard associations with sites via their ID reference. That is, every piece of equipment must contain a ref to its site. And you'll notice that it has an equipment marker tag and also has a ref, site ref. And finally, points represent a sensor, control point, or other item that has data values associated with it. And points have a relationship with their equipment site via ID reference. So every point has a reference to its equip in the site that it's a part of. is kind of core to modeling systems and things like that. Slide 21, I'm going to skip, but this is just how complex something like an air handling unit could be modeled. It's online as well. Slide 22. In addition to just the model itself, we described some data formats. Statetech defines some standard data exchange formats. These can be used for passing tags over the network or storing them in a file on a file system. Having well-defined formats for data exchange is extremely useful and kind of necessary for composing systems that understand the HSEC data model. So we can encode or serialize entities. It's just a map of tags. If we have a list or set of entities, we can represent them as a grid. We call it a grid, but it's logically a table. And we have defined some standardized encodings for HSEC entities. The first one, ZINC, kind of a clever acronym, means ZINC is not CSV. We'll explore it in a little more detail in a second, but basically ZINC encoding yields the fullest fidelity when encoding HSEC data. Unlike CSV, ZINC allows for types, scalar values in the columns, and also we can have arbitrary metadata at the grid or table level and at the individual column level. So ZINC is a really important encoding. And we also define a standard for encoding HSEC entities in JSON and CSV, and this is all on the website. Slide 23. We'll talk a little bit about grids. We said a list of entities could be represented in a tabular format called a grid, and that's what this is demonstrating. We have two entities at the top, site A and site B, and they're both sites. One has an area and one has a phone number. And when you view it in a tabular format, you can see that we have a sparse table, really, of those values. Slide 24, I'm going to skip the details on the website, but this just shows how you can go from a grid to the actual ZINC encoding. Slide 25, HSEC also defines an HTTP protocol for HSEC servers. So the HSEC REST API defines a simple mechanism to exchange HSEC tag data over HTTP. The HSEC REST server implements a set of POPs or operations, and we have some standardized ones that every server must support. And you can also add your own into your own HSEC server. And basically the way it works is you make HTTP requests that are HSEC grids, and you get a HSEC response as a grid. And we support GITs and POSTs as different ways of sending that data and receiving it. You can do content negotiation if you want ZINC for CSV or JSON. And the standard URL for a HSEC server would be the server name / HSEC, and then the ops you're invoking. Slide 26, I'm going to skip the gory details of what one of those requests would look like. Slide 27, I'll also skip, but this just lists some of the standard ops, and they're all listed online with detailed explanations of what they achieve. Just one I would point out is that you can do things like watches, which allow you to subscribe to point values as they're changing over time, which is kind of cool. All right, slide 28. I want to do a practical example of a real-world application using HSEC. So at Sky Foundry, we've created a software suite called SkySpark. This is really kind of HSEC in action. SkySpark allows domain experts to use their knowledge, capture their knowledge and rules that automatically run against collected data. So at the heart of SkySpark is an analytics engine that employs semantic tagging, pattern recognition, functional rules, processing, and other techniques to automatically identify issues. We talked about how BAS systems make it so easy to gain access to equipment data. SkySpark provides a collection of connectors, which allow us to import data into the software and normalize it using HSEC conventions, if it's not already in HSEC. So we can pull in data from BACnet or OBase or Modbus, Sedona, et cetera. And then we store the tags in a HSEC tag database. We call that Folio. Folio is a highly optimized database, which efficiently manages real-time and time series data from building systems. The tags provide the hooks that the analytics engine uses to correlate and analyze the data. So analysis is accomplished with a unique computation engine. We call it Axon. The system implementer writes rules using the Axon language, which are then processed by the Axon engine. You define a rule once, activate it, and then SkySpark continues to use it forever. The rules hit or trigger, they create a spark, and that's our term for an issue that matters. Finally, slide, what was that, 29? This just shows an example from our SiteSpark app. The purple runtime, what we're seeing here is the purple runtime chart at the top shows one of the spark rules that hit and for how long it hit. In this case, you're looking at a rule called lights on and unoccupied. It's a pretty simple rule, which, as you might imagine, indicates condition. The lights are on in the building, but the schedule said it was an unoccupied node. And then you can see at the bottom the data points that were used to help calculate that spark. You can see that the status of the lights was on from 12 a.m. to roughly 2, and that the occupancy should have only been occupied from 10 a.m. to 2. So we would have expected the blue to only be basically that green box to be the time when the lights were on. This type of application shows the power of having a common ontology or vocabulary for modeling building automation systems. The rules run against Folio using standard haystack tags for data query. The points and equipment are modeled using haystack tags. And the best part is, this Spark rule, once verified and tested, is now valid for all building systems that have control for lighting and have occupancy schedules, which is pretty much every building. We have found an exceptional condition in our system. We can now go about fixing it. If we have energy meter data available and tariff information, we can even associate costs with the Spark so building managers can know how much this is costing them. The possibilities are endless, and this is a simple rule with a simple error condition. All this is possible because of Project Haystack and having a standard, common model and vocabulary for reasoning about these systems. Slide 30, just going to highlight a few resources, the Project Haystack website, where you can see all the docs for the formats, protocols, and tags. We also have a form where people can contribute their knowledge to the Project Haystack. We have a conference coming up in May in Denver, Colorado, and find out more about Sky Foundry and our product at our website. I want to thank everyone for listening and look forward to answering any questions.
Thanks, Matthew. That was very interesting. Thank you. And we've got just over 30 minutes for questions and things. So, great. The way we normally work with questions is see a little hand towards the lower right side of your screen. Don't write anything next to the hand, whatever you do. So just click on the hand to let us know that you're ready to ask the question, and that hand actually toggles, so you can toggle it back when you're done. So first question from Steve Ray. Steve. Steve, you're on. You may need to unmute locally. That's it.
Okay. Sorry, I was muted. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay. Quick question from Matthew. I typed it in the chat, but I was looking on your website trying to find the model or the ontology that I could download to peruse for how Haystack actually relates entities like HVACs to power sources or whatever. I couldn't find any model. All I saw was the description of your tags. Could you sort of expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Am I unmuted? Yeah. So on the Project Haystack website, you'll see that we have high-level descriptions of how we would model things like energy meters and site meters, and then also how we would measure building equipment systems such as AHUs or chillers or whatever. And really, how you model them within your buildings or sites to you at that point. The power of the reference is that, like, for example, the way we model it in SkySpark is we will say that a piece of equipment is has a load or an electric meter load from some other piece of equipment. For example, so we'll associate equipment with the meters that they're tied to, like all your lighting systems might be on the same meter. And then by checking those references, we can associate the cost or how much energy the lighting system is using and correlate that towards the metering data. So how you relate these things at certain levels is kind of up to you and how you want to model it, but at the end of the day, a meter is still modeled the same way, an AHU is still modeled the same way, and then you can make your own relationships between them. Does that sort of answer your question?
Sort of, although if it's up to you, then how are you going to get interoperability between different vendors if a different vendor is expecting a relationship to be different, I guess?
Well, we do have some tags. I don't want to go through all the tags specifically, but like if you look at like the electrical metering section for energy, you will see that the way we associate equipment with the there's some standard tags you can use to reference the meters that your equipment is a load for. So that would be the standard way of doing it. You're specifically asking about like energy management. Yeah.
Okay, I'll take a look. Thanks.
Yeah.
So I actually had a related question myself, which I think might relate to that. So in your meta model slide, you described the meta model for this. So have I understood it right that you're asserting semantics in terms of these are real business concepts and these elements in the model correspond to those business concepts using your meta model? I'm curious why you chose not to use, for example, the OWL meta model to make those kinds of assertions. Why did you do it the way you did?
I don't know that I have the specific answer to that question, since I was not involved in the creation of Project HSAC, but I do think I have an idea about maybe some reasons for that, being in the building automation industry for a little bit here. I think people have attempted to make OWL representations or models of building equipment and their relationships to one another, and for various reasons has not met a lot of, or it's met a lot of resistance or not gained traction. Maybe it's perceived as overly complex or difficult to make sense of for our industry. So this just seems to have been something that people were willing to contribute to and make sense to them and gaining traction within the building automation industry.
Interesting, thanks. Ken Bukowski, you have a question.
Yes, that's a question in general for all three speakers. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah, the kinds of decisions that seem to be being made in this case are ones where you seem to be making the assumption that there is one unique correct answer and the issue is just finding it. What could your systems do if that wasn't the case, that you were trying to make a decision in, say, a business context where it's not clear there is one correct answer and that you have to deal with subtle trade-offs between different possible answers, different possible solutions to a problem? To use an example that was in one of the talks, there is a correct answer to the question of who the running mate was for Gerald Ford, but what about the decision Gerald Ford had to make in order to choose that running mate? Could your systems handle this kind of a decision?
Yeah, Bill, do you want to go first on that one?
Sure. So I think the WASM framework is generally reasonably well suited to that kind of decision. I think a lot of the details would need to change. I mean, WASM's reasonably good at handling cases where there are multiple alternative correct answers. You can train the system by saying, these seven answers, any of these seven answers is right, and then it will learn to recognize things that look like any of those seven, and then at test time you get similar behaviors. But that's not quite the same as multiple alternative right answers is not quite the same as supporting a decision where there's degrees of rightness, degrees and sort of a subjective how much do you want it. Like this, like who should be chosen to be vice president would be a good example of something where that you'd want to train it with some amount of these are known to be good answers, these are known to be fairly good answers, these are obviously terrible answers. And then at test time, I think you could get similar behaviors, but I think the kinds of features you would want for making those judgments would be different because they're not so much features about is there something saying that this is right, but rather there's something about sort of indirect characteristics that would lead you to conclude that something's right. So I think you'd need a lot more knowledge and a lot and very different knowledge to build that application. But I think it can be done, and I think the framework that we have is not a bad fit for that.
Thanks. Matthew?
Well, we're not making the same kinds of decisions that, for example, Watson would be making. We're making very specific, domain-specific questions, answering specific questions about is my lights on in my building or not. So there's not a lot of guessing involved. We know exactly what we want to go get and we kind of query for it using the HSAC filtering and capabilities or the Axon language to do more sophisticated analysis of those points.
What if you did want to answer a question like, should the lights be on my building? Would I be better off if I turn the lights on?
So in that case, what you would probably do, we wouldn't have like a sophisticated rules engine in the sense of trying to decide should you. You would go back and basically analyze by writing Axon code to answer that question for you. Like it would be a function of a number of variables, like for example, the cost and the time of day and scheduling and things like that. And that's actually one of the things we're trying to solve because it's a huge benefit for energy analysis in buildings. Like a lot of money can be saved there. So trying to figure out, should I be running my lights or not? Generally, the answer is the less you can be running them, the better. Or depending on the time of day and time of use schedule, things like that too. So you go back and historically analyze the impact, basically, is kind of how we would approach it. And then you can make predictions from there.
Thanks. Unfortunately, Marco has had to drop off. So, Ken, you'll only get the answer from two out of our three speakers. So, apologies for that. Any follow-up on that before we go to the next question? Okay. So, Peter Yim, you have a question.
Peter Yim, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I have a couple of questions for Matthew. Let's get this simple one out of the way first. I probably missed something. On your slide 24, a couple of slides earlier, you said sync is not CSV, and I failed to discern why it isn't CSV. Can you elaborate a little bit, just out of curiosity?
Sure, I'm happy to. Yeah, I kind of blew through that for the interest of time, but the reason Zinc is not CSV is primarily because of the typed data, like the columns are typed. So because of the encoding of the data values, when we serialize it and deserialize it, we know exactly what kind of type each column represents or each value within the column. And so you'll not confuse like a URI from a string, like whereas in CSV, you wouldn't know whether any given value was a string or a URI, for example, unless you encoded it in a very special way. So this information is kind of just carried into Zinc natively. And in the addition, we have a standard way of including metadata, which is basically tags for the grid itself. And again, metadata tags for the column information. That's the biggest difference.
Okay. The other, I don't know if you have been in our earlier sessions, but more than once we heard descriptions of the semantic sensor network ontology, which some of the presenters talked about. Evidently, what you're working at, draws a lot of parallels with the type of work they are doing. Are you guys coordinated, or do they have the SAT group have people in your working group and vice versa?
I have not been on the previous calls, and I am not familiar with the semantic system network topology, though I will look it up now. We may have members who are involved in both. I would not be aware one way or the other, but I'd have to look into it.
I think that you guys, both parties would probably be able to draw a bit of synergy out of working together, and then the SSNO work at W3C.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great talk.
Thanks. Mark Underwood, you have a question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Great talks, all three. This question's for Bill. I put this in the chat too, but when we're looking at IoT systems, and I know the slide deck you had wasn't pitched directly at that, but when we look at IoT systems, we have typically a mix of machine automation solutions like the one that was just presented, and ones where we have a specialist, like somebody in municipal operations who's responsible for traffic flow or some other urban planning setting where they, for example, might want to look at a range of answers in response to measurements provided by field. So I'm curious, as Watson has moved away from the purely Jeopardy model toward the smart building, smart city stuff, how you've wrestle with that difference.
So I'm not particularly familiar with what's going on with Watson and smart cities, if anything. But I can sort of answer the question more generally that in these cases where you have like a fully automated system where you really have low tolerance or no tolerance for wrong answers because the thing has to take some action in the real world, which has severe consequences if it gets something wrong, I think you need in that case to be operating with a system that's very rule-based and very precise and formal and logical. Watson has all those capabilities. They have some impact in something like Jeopardy. It can go, like, for example, if you have a question asking for what actor was in these two different movies, it can go to the knowledge base and say there's this overlap in IMDb between actors in this movie and actors in this movie, and it isolates you down to one answer. So all that stuff's there, and when it works, it gets you really high precise results with really high confidence. But it covers a very small fraction of Jeopardy and a very small fraction of the questions that we see in a lot of these broader applications. And so the rule-based things are very precise and specific, but they often have much more narrow applicability, a range of things they can handle. Mm-hmm. I think you would want to restrict yourself to something like that and be sort of limited and more and less broad in the range of things you can do in an automated context. Where you do have a specialist and you're trying to just get information to put in front of a specialist for that specialist to then look at and make sense of and decide what to do with, you can be a lot more aggressive and you can, I think, bring in a much broader range of Watson's capabilities to go out and analyze text and find useful information and show it to a user. So I think that part of Smarter Cities is a better fit for Watson on the whole. But either one could be a fit since both capabilities are in there, and it's just a matter of how do you configure Watson and what kind of training data do you give it. If you give it all training data where everything can be handled through these automatic rule-based systems, it'll learn to trust the rule-based system and not bother with anything else. So it can work in that environment too. It's just a matter of what kind of data does it have and what kind of rules are available for it.
Okay, that's great. That makes sense. So, and one other follow-up that's a bit unrelated is in our previous sessions, we've only touched lightly on the role of the natural language aspect in IoT systems, and this is a strength, and you didn't focus on this much in the slide deck, but I know this is a strength of the project in general. Is would you want to address the role that could play in dealing with IoT systems generally?
So I think that there's, it's great that there's lots of information out there from IoT, and Watson's always hungry for more information, more things that can train it to recognize things that are right and things that are wrong. Watson is most suited to language information, and there is some of that out there, and sifting through large amounts of language information and finding things that are sort of relevant or useful to a particular task or goal. So I think that's really where Watson plays best, is in those kinds of gathering large information, especially gathering large amounts of information to show to human users who have some amount of tolerance for impreciseness is I think where I would see Watson fitting in.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions? So I'm looking at the chat. Marco had to drop off, but he's answered his questions. Most of the other questions have been addressed except for John Morris. Could you, Greg, your hand is up as well. Could you ask your question, please? Thanks.
Yes, this is John, and just wanted to share the question that I've put in the chat here, and this would be a specific opportunity for building automation in terms of looking at onboarding boilers for a service contract, for example. And if you look at the large populations of boilers, there are going to be many different models. And this is both a technical challenge and a modeling challenge in terms of abstracting out that interface so that we can have some kind of a consistent and centralized control for which the project or program would have been initiated in the first place. That is to say, multiple different boiler models, they need to be censored in a different way. But at some point, we'd like to see that common view, which will enhance our management control. I'm wondering if Haystack has the capability of addressing a problem or an opportunity like that.
Is it Mark asking the question?
Yes, that would make sense.
Yeah, okay, it's Mark. So I'll click in the link to boiler information on Project ASEC. You know, I look at it and you'll see there's a big to-do there. So I think it could. I'm not a boiler domain expert by any stretch of the imagination. And this is one of the reasons it's so important that it's a open initiative, an open source initiative. People have domain expertise in boilers and how they should be modeled and the kind of points on them. You can contribute your knowledge and propose a specification and model for boilers, and I think that would really help our community. I know it's a big piece that we're still looking to get done. So the answer is it could, but we haven't done it yet. We're looking for people to help on this area.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. So a couple of other questions here, unless anybody's about to put their hands up. We were talking earlier about the meta model and the choice between an existing meta model like the web ontology language versus the simple pragmatic meta model of Haystack. And you'll see a little conversation with Steve Ray and Amanda Weisden, who unfortunately had to drop off, sort of filling in the gaps of some of what that would look like and so on. So Steve, I wonder, would you want to sort of amplify on any of your comments there in terms of how, you know, in particular, thinking about how we can then, you know, how Haystack can then, you know, make use of the semantic sensor network and vice versa and stuff like that. Any thoughts?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. In fact, my last comment there on the chat is I think that Matthew, this group at the Ontolog Forum is full of people who would be exactly the kind of people you probably want to involve in the Project Haystack, to take what you've done and actually build an ontology out of it, because you've done a lot of the heavy lifting of collecting all the concepts together, and then you could take things where in your talk you were talking about something references something else, and we might want to, you know, refine what you mean by references and, you know, make that more concise and turn the whole thing into some kind of a either information model or ontology that can be machine compiled. This seems to be the next logical step here.
Yeah, I think that would be great. In some ways, Project Haystack was born out of a practical need from a business perspective. We were trying to solve a real problem in this domain, and this is what the people were most willing to get behind, and it's been extremely successful in the sense that we've built a lot of interesting systems that are based off this, but there's definitely still work to be done. And since it is an open community where no one person kind of runs the show, if people here are really interested in this kind of thing, I would really encourage you to become a member of the community and contribute your knowledge and provide some examples or even lead us in this direction of how we can do the things you're talking about. That would be really helpful.
I would just follow up with, there is a lot of activity in, among other places, an organization called the Smart Grid Interoperability Panel, where there's a lot of building automation standards being developed as we speak. For example, the ASHRAE standard SPC 201, which is colloquially called the Facility Smart Grid Information Model, which I and actually Joel Bender, who's on the call, is also involved in. We should probably talk sometime and see how the Haystack can synergize with some of these standards that are getting a lot of support from communities like the BACnet community and the utilities.
Right. Definitely.
Fantastic. And, welcome to the Internet of Things. excellent. Yeah. Thanks. Bobby in Tea Garden, you have a question.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
This is for William. Regarding the learned models that you're referring to in slide 4 onward, are they temporary models for the topic at hand, and are they stored for later use or stored and digested to a larger set of knowledge or ontologies?
Great question. So we have, so mostly they're temporary. Mostly they're for particular applications, and they tend to be at a very sort of abstract level of things like how important is the grammatical structure of a piece of text to determining whether it's answering a question versus how important is just a bag of words. So something like that, which you'd think could be widely applicable across a wide variety of different applications. And if you learn something in one application, it would probably be more or less applicable in another as well. But in practice, we've found that really you're better off training for your particular application. Now, something we tried to do in the medical application specifically when we first started was we tried to take the Jeopardy models, which we thought were very general purpose, and then just customize them automatically for the medical by putting in a little extra medical specific training data to learn how much to trust those versus how much to trust the raw features. But what we found was very quickly that if you get enough training data, you're better off just training on that application, on just the medical application, and not bothering with the Jeopardy model for your purposes, that it's not adding much over just training. Now, if you don't have enough data to train for your particular application, then maybe you're better off using the Jeopardy model. But you'd have to have just the right amount to want to try and use both, to try and to take the Jeopardy model and do some additional retraining to customize it, but not to go all the way to training a whole model just for medical. And rarely you have that sort of sweet spot. Usually you don't have enough data to do any training, and then you're just forced to use the model for some other application. Or you have enough data to do all the training, and then you just want to go ahead and do all the training for your application and not try and reuse older models that are less applicable to what you're trying to do. Did that make sense?
Yeah, well, really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. So any other questions? I've been looking through the chat in case I missed any. I missed Bobbin's one until then. I think we've covered everything that people were asking about on the chat. I'm very pleased to see we've opened up a new set of opportunities and synergies there for the building side of things. Gary, the costs. I see you just put a question in the chat. Do you want to expand on that question or comment? Maybe you don't have sound. right. Yes. So the air handling unit example shows some of the analysis steps you might go through.
Maybe you can hear me now.
Yes, we can.
Mike.
Yes.
So I just wanted to follow up to some of the things that were mentioned before about a connection to semantic sensor network that Peter Yim, for example, mentioned. I think when you look at some of the vocabularies in here, I was looking at the AHU one that you have in the presentation. I think, I'm not sure which slide it is, but in any event, you can see things in there that you can relate to the sensor network. There are sensor types that are in there in terms of humidity and temperature and things of that nature, CO2. But then there's also entities like air, various entities you model, identify, and then there are just subtypes of those types of things, you know. So in the chat, I just indicated an example of that. One thing that is maybe missing in here is process. So frequently we talk about how entities are involved in a process within a particular role and have certain attributes. It's often the case that when you just take that very simple model, you can take vocabularies and build conceptual models around those ideas pretty quickly, and then you can formalize those.
Matthew, any comments on that?
Is there a concern that the air handling unit is not represented itself, or for I'm trying to discern the question or your thought there?
Well, this is Gary again. It may be that air or the type of entity, the various entities that you're interested in, are not formally represented separately, but that you can build a relationship between those types of entities and processes that you might be interested in terms of your work and the attributes. A lot of work deals with attributes and measurements of attributes, but it turns out to relate those type of things and to show how various attributes are related with values, you need a more integrated model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's what we're trying to do with the project. So going to that air handling unit example here is on slide 21, just if anyone's still looking at the slides. We have a concept of the AHU entity within Project Haystack, and what this slide is was intended to demonstrate was each of those lines, discharge air, fan command, discharge air temp sensor, et cetera, are points within that air handling unit, and each point is an entity itself and has a relationship via reference to that AHU. So we are trying to model not just individual values, but the actual equipment itself, the collection of these points.
Yeah. One point I would make about that is we often are very concrete. So we have the idea of air discharge, but that's a discharge is essentially a process of which some parts of it that you're measuring. And maybe it may be important down the road to sort of have those processes included in the model.
Could you give a little more meat to that to help me understand, like, in what were the processes are not currently available in this model and how it would be used, just for my understanding?
Well, I don't really necessarily have enough from your slides to be able to say that, but if I look at one of your slides, site, equipment, and points, you're very object-oriented here. You have an idea of a site, you have the idea of equipment, you have the idea of some location or a point on there, and then you have something which is somewhere between an object and a process, which is weather. There could be weathering activities.
Right.
You often don't have these processes that connect what you're measuring at that point with that equipment at that location for some process that's of interest going on there.
Okay.
You could also call that an event going on there, which involves some participation of processes and entities at that location.
Okay. We can follow up on that. I might want to ask you a few more questions about that. Who was asking that question or commenting?
This is Gary Burcross. I have a comment in there a few lines up in the chat.
One thing I might just chip into that, I think you've clearly built a conceptual model, and the recommendation we've been talking about of reframing that in something like the web ontology language is that it provides an underlying formalism to the model framed in terms of formal first-order logic, and then that becomes the same formalisms that other models use, so then you can start to make reference to an existing process model or something like that. So it's all part of the opportunity space we were talking about earlier.
Right. Nothing that would prevent us, I think it would map fairly easily to our or some other ontologies very, very easily if work just has been done.
Yeah. Any other? Great. Steve, you came and went. Did you have a quick comment or?
No, I was just going to sort of support the kind of conversation that Gary was carrying on, the kind of process of analyzing, you know, whether weather is an event and time. That's exactly, I think, the kinds of questions that would be asked to in the process of turning this structure that exists into a more formal model. So, but that's already has been said, so I decided to not say it.
Okay, fantastic. Great. We have 3 minutes left. 2 minutes left. I think it's been a very good session. Some interesting opportunities and insights come out of it. Really interesting to see under the hood of Watson as well. And to echo Mark's point in the chat, I hope somebody from Watson will be able to come to our face-to-face meeting in Arlington. That would be fantastic if you can. And 3 very good presentations, really good insights into practical problem solving in that whole space. So thank you all very much. Are there any other last minute comments or questions before we sign off? I see a couple of people typing. Great. So So tune in next week. And what do we have next week? I forgot to remind myself, but I think it will be must be track D, I think. Let me just check, sorry. So next week is the 26th of March, and oh, I can't see what's coming up. Bear with me a second. We should have our next synthesis. So we've had the second round of presentations from all four tracks, A, B, C, and D. So as before, we'll be sitting down to synthesize the things we've learned from these sessions and start putting together something that we can put into the official communique, ready for us to then review that the following week and start preparing for attending the Ontology Summit Symposium. Also, stay tuned, keep an eye on the summit site for details about how to register for on-site participation in the face-to-face symposium, which is coming up on the 13th and 14th of April in Arlington, Virginia. I haven't yet seen registration details, but as soon as we have them, those should be added somewhere. You can find them from the summit homepage. So we look forward to seeing as many of you as possible in Arlington in a few weeks, and look forward to synthesizing all this good stuff and taking some of this, particularly that later conversation about some of the initiatives and opportunities and things that, that we've thought of today, and bringing that into the activity of synthesizing all of these lessons, you know, things like bringing together the semantic sensor network with the haystack stuff and things like that. And we'll see you all then. So thank you, everybody. Thank you particularly our three speakers, Marco and Bill and Matthew. And we'll see you all again soon.